Hi, this is Sandy Brewster. Hi, this is Sandy Brewster, and I'm coming to you again, reading from Jung, C.G. Jung, in his own words. Today we continue the third part of the essay on the relation of analytical psychology to poetry. This is the third and final section of the reading from this essay, from the book, from Collected Works, The Spirit in Man, Art, and Literature. When a little earlier we spoke of a work of art as a tree growing out of the nourishing soil, we might equally well have compared it to a child growing in the womb. But as all comparisons are lame, let us stick to the more precise terminology of science. You will remember that I described the nascent work in the psyche of the artist as an autonomous complex. By this we mean a psychic formation that remains subliminal until its energy charge is sufficient to carry it over the threshold into consciousness. Its association with consciousness does not mean that it is assimilated, only that it is perceived. But it is not subject to conscious control and can be neither inhibited nor voluntarily reproduced. Therein lies the autonomy of the complex. It appears and disappears in accordance with its own inherent tendencies, independently of the conscious will. The creative complex shares this peculiarity with every other autonomous complex. In this respect, it offers an analogy with pathological processes, since these two are characterized by the presence of autonomous complexes, particularly in the case of mental disturbances. The divine frenzy of the artist comes perilously close to a pathological state, though the two things are not identical. But the presence of autonomous complexes is not in itself pathological, since normal people too fall temporarily or permanently under their domination. This fact is simply one of the normal peculiarities of the psyche, and for a person to be unaware of the existence of an autonomous complex merely betrays a high degree of unconsciousness. Every typical attitude that is to some extent differentiated shows a tendency to become an autonomous complex, and in most cases, it actually does. Again, every instinct has more or less the character of an autonomous complex. In itself, therefore, an autonomous complex has nothing morbid about it. Only when its manifestations are frequent and disturbing is it a symptom of illness. How does an autonomous complex arise? For reasons which we cannot go into here, a hitherto unconscious portion of the psyche is thrown into activity and gains ground by activating the adjacent areas of association. The energy needed for this is naturally drawn from consciousness, unless the latter happens to identify with the complex. But where this does not occur, the drain of energy is produced. The intensity of conscious interest and activity gradually diminishes, leading either to apathy, a condition common with artists, or to a regressive development of the conscious functions. That is, they revert to an infantile and archaic level and undergo something like a degeneration. The inferior parts of the functions, as Genet calls them, push to the fore. The instinctual side of the personality prevails over the ethical, the infantile over the mature, and the unadapted over the adapted. This too is something we see in the lives of many artists. The autonomous complex thus develops by using the energy that has been withdrawn from the conscious control of the personality. And what does an autonomous creative complex consist? Of this, we can know next to nothing, so long as the artist's work affords us no insight into its foundations. The work presents us with a finished picture, and this picture is amenable to analysis only to the extent that we can recognize it as a symbol. But if we are unable to discover any symbolic value in it, we have merely established that, so far as we are concerned, it means no more than what it says, or to put it another way, that it is no more than what it seems to be. I use the word seems because our own bias may prevent a deeper appreciation of it. At any rate, we can find no incentive and no starting point for an analysis. But in the case of a symbolic work, we should remember the dictum of Gerard Hoffman: poetry evokes out of words the resonance of the primordial word. The question we should ask, therefore, is, what primordial image lies behind the imagery of art? This question needs a little elucidation. I am assuming that the work of art we propose to analyze, as well as being symbolic, has its source not in the personal unconscious of the poet, but in a sphere of unconscious mythology whose primordial images are the common heritage of mankind. I have called this sphere the collective unconscious to distinguish it from the personal unconscious. The latter I regard as the sum total of all those psychic processes and contents which are capable of becoming conscious, and often do, but are then suppressed because of their incompatibility and kept subliminal. Art receives tributaries from this sphere too, but muddy ones, and their predominance, far from making a work of art a symbol, merely turns it into a symptom. We can leave this kind of art without injury and without regret to the purgative methods employed by Freud. In contrast to the personal unconscious, which is a relatively thin layer immediately below the threshold of consciousness, the collective unconscious shows no tendency to become conscious under normal conditions, nor can it be brought back to recollection analytical technique, since it was never repressed or forgotten. The collective unconscious is not to be thought of as a self-subsistent entity. It is no more than a potentially handed down to us from primordial times in the specific form of mnemonic images or inherited in the anatomical structure of the brain. There are no inborn ideas, but there are inborn possibilities of ideas that set bounds to even the boldest fantasy and keep our fantasy activity within certain categories. A priori ideas, as it were, the existence of which cannot be ascertained except from their effects. They appear only in the shaped material of art as the regulative principles that shape it, that is to say, only by inference drawn from the finished work can we reconstruct the age-old original of the primordial image. The primordial image or archetype is a figure, be it a daemon, a human being, or a process that constantly recurs in the course of history and appears wherever creative fantasy is freely expressed. Essentially, therefore, it is a mythological figure. When we examine these images more closely, we find that they give form to countless typical experiences of our ancestors. They are, so to speak, the psychic residua of innumerable experiences of the same type. They present a picture of psychic life in the average, divided up and projected into the manifold figures of the mythological pantheon. But the mythological figures are themselves products of creative fantasy and still have to be translated into conceptual languages. Only the beginnings of such a language exist. But once the necessary concepts are created, they could give us an abstract, scientific understanding of the unconscious processes that lie at the roots of the primordial images. In each of these images, there is a little piece of human psychology and human fate, a remnant of the joys and sorrows that have been repeated countless times in our ancestral history, and on the average, and the average follow ever the same course. It is like a deeply graven riverbed in the psyche, in which the waters of life, instead of flowing along as before in a broad but shallow stream, suddenly swell into a mighty river. This happens whenever that particular set of circumstances is encountered, which over long periods of time has helped to lay down the primordial image. The moment when this mythological situation reappears is always characterized by a particular emotional intensity. It is as though chords in us were struck that had never resounded before, as though forces whose existence we never suspected were unloosed. What makes the struggle for adaptation so laborious is the fact that we have constantly to be dealing with individual and atypical situations. So it is not surprising that when an archetypal situation occurs, we suddenly feel an extraordinary sense of release, as though transported or caught up by an overwhelming power. At such moments, we are no longer individuals, but the race, the voice of all mankind, resounds in us. The individual man cannot use his powers to the full unless he is aided by one of these collective representations we call ideals, which releases all the hidden forces of instinct that are inaccessible to his conscious will. The most effective ideals are always fairly obvious variants of an archetype, as is evident from the fact that they lend themselves to allegory. The ideal of the mother country, for instance, is an obvious allegory of the mother, as is the fatherland of the father. Its power to stir us does not derive from the allegory, but from the symbolic value of our native land. The archetype here is the participation mystique, with the soil on which individuals dwell and which contains the spirits of the ancestors. The impact of an archetype, whether it takes the form of immediate experience or is expressed through the spoken word, stirs us because it summons up a voice that is stronger than our own. Whoever speaks in primordial images speaks with a thousand voices. He enthralls and overpowers, while at the same time, he lifts the idea he is seeking to express out of the occasional and the transitory into the realm of the ever-enduring. He transmutes our personal destiny into the destiny of mankind and evokes in us all those beneficent forces that ever and anon have enabled mankind to stand and to find a refuge from every peril and to outlive the longest night. That is the secret of great art and its effect upon us. The creative process, so far as we are able to follow it at all, consists in the unconscious activity of an archetypal image and in elaborating and shaping this image into the finished work. Giving it shape, the artist translates it into the language of the present and so makes it possible for us to find our way back to the deepest springs of life. Therein lies the social significance of art. It is constantly at work educating the spirit of the age, conjuring up the forms in which the age is most lacking. The unsatisfied yearning of the artist reaches back to the primordial image in the unconscious, which is best fitted to compensate the inadequacy and one-sidedness of the present. The artist seizes on this image, and in raising it from deepest unconsciousness, he brings it into relation with conscious values, thereby transforming it until it can be accepted by the minds of his contemporaries according to their powers. Peoples and times, like individuals, have their own characteristic tendencies and attitudes. The very word attitude betrays the necessary bias that every marked tendency entails. Direction implies exclusion, and exclusion means that very many psychic elements that could play their part in life are denied the right to exist because they are incompatible with the general attitude. The normal man can follow the general trend without injury to himself. But the man who takes to the back streets and alleys because he cannot endure the broad highway will be the first to discover the psychic elements that are waiting to play their part in the life of the collective. Here, the artist's relative lack of adaptation turns out to his advantage. It enables him to follow his own yearnings far from the beaten path and to discover what it is that would meet the unconscious needs of his age. Thus, just as the one-sidedness of the individual's conscious attitude is corrected by reactions from the unconscious, so art represents a process of self-regulation in the life of nations and epochs. I am aware that in this lecture I have only been able to sketch out my views in the barest outline, but I hope that what I have been obliged to admit, that is to say, their practical application to poetic works of art, has been furnished by your own thoughts, thus giving flesh and blood to my abstract intellectual frame. And so ends the third reading of C.G. Jung in his own words on the relation of analytical psychology to poetry. Thank you for listening today, and I will be reading from the collected works again next week. Goodbye.